Grab your Tupperware and put your work down. It's time for KZSU's Monday Lunch Hour. Been exercising lately? How's your diet? How much do you know, and I mean really know, about nutrition, health, and general well-being? What does it take to stay in shape and keep the right perspective on your body and your health? Well, today on the Lunch Hour, we're going to get into all of that and more with Dr. Clyde Wilson. Thanks for tuning in, and stay with us. Dr. Clyde Wilson is an adjunct professor in both the School of Medicine and the Department of Athletics here at Stanford, as well as the School of Medicine at UC San Francisco. Since earning his PhD in the Department of Chemistry here at Stanford in 2002, he's been busy teaching courses in nutrition, food pharmacology, and human movement. He's written two books, including Endurance Nutrition, Troubleshooting Guide, and What, When, and Water, Nutrition for Weight Loss Wellness. He is also very engaged in public outreach, including work with the nonprofit Sports Medicine Institute here in Palo Alto, and maintains his own extensive website, drclydewilson.com. Dr. Wilson, thanks for coming, and welcome to KZSU's Monday Lunch Hour.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
So one thing I left out in the intro was you spent some time in the Navy, and having done some work, looking into your background, it sounds like you had a very formative experience. I was wondering if you could share that story with us.
Absolutely. After a couple years of training, I was out in the Pacific Ocean for a couple years, plus a couple years in overhaul up in the Seattle area, and it was soon after getting to the ship in the middle of the Pacific, kind of with a slight drift back and forth. Carriers don't waddle too much, but you can detect a little bit. And I still remember sitting in the doctor's office for my regular physical, because I had just gotten to the ship, and he tells me, you're class 3 obese, you've got 300 cholesterol, and I didn't realize how bad that was at the time, and we need to measure your blood pressure a few times a day for the next half week, figure out what kind of medications to put you on. It scared me to death. I felt like I was one foot in the grave, only 20 years old. So how did I get to that point? Well, my best friend in high school, Marlon, his dad competed in the 76 Olympics representing Cuba as an Olympic lifter. And he told Marlon and I, if you train like monsters and eat like monsters, you'll be monsters. And adolescent males would like nothing more than to have higher tribal status at school, which is exactly what we targeted with all our training and our eating. I didn't realize that that would hurt me so much. So the doctor, now fast forward back to the ship, planted this seed in my head with the following statement: do you realize you're killing yourself with food? I had never correlated in my mind food with suicide before. And I've spent the next 23 years till today, I was 20 at the time, 43 now, thinking about that, how we can hurt ourselves with our instinctual drive to do things, which under other circumstances might be good for you. You know, if you're in a region of scarcity, finding carbs and detecting them on your tongue and liking them will help you to survive. But that's not the kind of environment we're in anymore. And particularly if you're using weight training, or if you're depressed and you're using sugar to counter that, there's always excuses, or you don't have time for healthy food, so you just grab whatever you can on the go. There's always just the endless internal and external excuses that we can have for eating too many calories, or calories that digest too quickly. So here I am with all these problems, now with a fear factor. And we know that the dopamine that drives you to eat sugar is countered by acetylcholine that makes you not want to if you're scared to death because you now know that the sugar is killing you. So I have this chemical battle happening in the limbic system, the emotion center in my brain, particularly the nucleus accumbens, this little almond-sized shaped thing near my brainstem. And there's this chemical battle going on now. Dopamine making me want the sugar, acetylcholine making me realize that it's killing me. And the doctor scared me sufficiently that I made change. I didn't make enough change over the long term back then, but I have in increments over the last couple decades, and ultimately pretty happy with my health level. But at the time, made enough change for my cholesterol to drop 30 points, which is 10% of the total, started out as 300, in just 2 months. there's a lot of research out there where people drop that much, like on statins or with super healthy eating and metabolic labs for a few weeks. But my doctor had never seen anything like that. And it wasn't until a couple decades later where I'm teaching this stuff where I appreciated how effective eating healthier was. So what does that mean? You're in the middle of the ocean. You're eating in a cafeteria on a ship with 6,000 other people. How healthy can you eat? I had never noticed the basket of hard-boiled eggs. I was eating these greasy eggs that was literally floating in grease on the tray. And so I switched to the hard-boiled eggs. Instead of brown sugar in the oatmeal, I put fruit. Instead of the syrup on the pancakes, I put peanut butter. So I just noticed things and differently. Suddenly became aware of stuff that I hadn't been aware of up until that stage, and it had a huge impact. Because I was so focused on my health all of a sudden, I stopped supplementing completely. Even with a relatively low income, I was spending $2,000 a year, and that's practically, at the time, 10% of my income on supplements. Everything that muscle and fiction said that I should be putting in my body, I was putting in my body, and all I wanted was just to get stronger, barely did any cardio. All of a sudden, I'm eating healthier because I'm scared to death of death at this very young age. And suddenly, my bench is past 300, my squat's over 400, my VO2 max goes up. I mean, I wasn't measuring it, but later, years later, I measured it, and I get a sense that it raised by at least 20%. It was profound to me how much my performance went up concurrent to my health. It was the first time that I realized I should have thought about this previous, but it took this experience. The body's a machine. When you put the right stuff into a machine, just like when you put the right stuff into your car, it's not just faster, but it's more efficient, and it goes more years. All three at the same time. All these various components of quality of life, which from the perspective of a human being would mean that you have greater mental acuity and reaction time, so there's a greater mental performance piece, there's the greater physical performance piece, and then a greater number of years to act out those aspects of performance, because it's the total accumulation of daily quality of life that makes up your total quality of life while you're here. When I asked the doctor, how do I eat better? He crunched up his face and said with a question in response to my question, maybe eat less fats? Well, eating in an aircraft carrier is like eating in a cafeteria. If you're going to eat less fats, you're basically not eating. So when we pulled into port, I go to a bookstore, and I'm looking at all these books, and they say opposite things. MDs and PhDs from all over the place are saying high protein, low protein, high carb, low carb, high plants, plants doesn't matter, or just eat less, count the points, count the blocks, like the zone. It was all over the place. So I'm thinking to myself, well, let's take a book that's written by the most MDs and PhDs at the same time, because maybe their homogenized thoughts will give me something useful, because I'm feeling like it's just a crapshoot, and I'm throwing darts in the dark. That didn't help, because when they wrote a book together, they all were all of the like mind. And then another book written by five of them said the opposite. So I leave the bookstore with frustration instead of a book, and I use my own common sense, which was thinking about what am I eating, when am I eating it, and how am I hydrating? What, when, and what are you doing? Fast forward two decades, now I'm teaching food pharmacology in the med schools at Stanford and UCSF, and what I'm telling people is, in some sense, the opposite of what I was thinking 20 years ago. I felt like all these experts were disagreeing with each other. Now I realize that they're all agreeing. If you know the old Indian story of the blind men that are investigating the elephant, because the king asked them to describe the elephant, and the one touching the tusks thinks that it's like a marble column. The one touching the tail thinks it's like a vine in the jungle. The one touching the legs thinks it's like a tree in the bark, etc. And they're fighting over this. And yet it's all the same. It's just the elephant. It's a different perspective. So if you put your blinders on too tightly, you'll see one aspect of nutrition. So the question is, what's the elephant? And the elephant is metabolism. So now I'm realizing if you use all the fad diets as your toolkit, then different approaches will work better under different circumstances. You go to an Italian restaurant, you want pasta, you take half home so you don't spike your blood sugar. Or if you want more of it, you eat a salad to slow down its digestion. There's so many ways to slow down the glycemic load. There's no reason for us to fight over nutrition or think that there is so much discord when the science is all the same for all of us. It boggles my mind why we even bother arguing about it. And I first came face to face with this massive battle of wills and thoughts, irrespective of what the research says underneath, how we fight each other over ideas, the same way as we fight over different religions when underneath they are so similar. That day in that bookstore after pulling into port when my doctor given me that news.
It's incredible. I mean, it sounds like a very profound realization out there in the middle of the Pacific. And, you know, it could be said that that's an overstatement to equate how you eat with suicide, but I don't think it is. I guess the difference is time scale a little bit, huh?
Well, once you know that something is bad for you, if it's really bad for you, if you don't stop, you'll be dead soon. Like riding without a motorcycle helmet, you might never have an accident, but you could have an accident today, right? So there's kind of a potential imminent issue. With food, there's almost a sense that at each New Year's, you can do your New Year's resolution. If it doesn't work out, maybe next year. And after 10 years, well, maybe even one more year will be okay. And then eventually, there will be a death scare from one's doctor. And that is what gets people to change. I once had a client who did nothing that I had suggested to her after working with her for a few hours. And then she gets breast cancer 1 year later and changed everything overnight. Shocking. I had a personal family friend tell me, without bacon, life's not worth living. She only had 30% flow in her outer carotid artery to her brain. You can't do surgery on that. The other one only had 50% less. Goes on a skiing trip, quaternary bypass, comes back. She's eating soy tofu and turkey, bacon and turkey bacon. I said, well, what about life not being worth living? A near-death experience profoundly changes how good food tastes or does not taste. Like for me personally, now that I know how bad my health, you know, whatever predispositions I have, and there's usually genetic factors with all of us, but no matter what your genetics is, the healthier you eat, the better off you are. And so in my case, eating pizza by itself, I know that it hurts me and it tastes different. To me, pizza by itself tastes like body fat and death, and that does not taste good.
But you had to retrain your brain to get there, right? Or did
fear
you?
Fear does that. Mm. You know, it's interesting. I call things where I don't have direct evidence from the scientific literature Clyde theory. So here's a piece of Clyde theory. When you look into the scientific literature, what you find is dopamine drives us to do things, and if you respond and follow the commands of your brain, follow what the dopamine is telling you to do, like eat sugar, for example, then opioids are released, which is kind of a feel-good. So we are rewarded, like getting a pat on the back, by our own brain in response to doing what our brain tells us to do. So in my case, what do I want to do? I want to eat pizza and ice cream. Those are my two favorite foods. But once I get a death scare, then there's enough acetylcholine being released. So like a anorexic bulimic, for example, a person who binges and purges, the dopamine drive for the sugar is so strong that they'll binge. But once that's satisfied, the dopamine level drops to less than the acetylcholine drive to do the purge. So now the purge begins, and eventually the dopamine drives back up. So it's like a seesaw, a chemical seesaw that's going back and forth. And in my case, I don't go through the seesaw in the order of an hour, like a person that's with that medical condition, but rather the dopamine drive accumulated throughout my life. Like my grandma gave me so much sweets when I was little that I had all my teeth capped silver when I was 2 years old. So I was habituated to sugar intake when I was very young. Once you're habituated to something, it's very hard to go back, particularly when your nervous system is in its formative years. So I have probably a more permanent drive for sugar than your average person would. Of course, you can binge enough later on that it'll get just as bad or worse. But I have this issue from very early on, and I ate differently from my two brothers because of that experience. It just happened to be that my grandma was more around in my first 2 years of life as opposed to my brothers. And so my eating pattern ended up different to this day. But because of the scare from my doctor and that acetylcholine suddenly is higher, that was a new chemical signal. That was not something that had been there before, and it changed my perception of how good the sugar tastes. with mice, when you put sugar into their tongue and they swallow it, and there's sugar sensors in the intestines, so the body knows that the calories have arrived, which does not happen with low-calorie sweeteners, which is why low-calorie sweetener intake increases how much you consume after a few months, because the brain realizes that sweet sensation is not necessarily correlated anymore to sugars actually arriving. You put sweeteners into mice, and you put lithium chloride, which is a nausea agent, into their stomach. After just a couple days, they don't want the sugar anymore, even when you don't give them the lithium chloride anymore. The nausea reaction, just for a couple days to the sugar, and this is one of the reasons that gastric bypass will initially work, because when you try to eat food, there's a nausea reaction, and that nausea reaction is driven by acetylcholine. So when you have nausea, like say you like ice cream, but you eat so much that you vomit, now you've got acetylcholine in response to ice cream, so you don't even want any for a month until that memory in your brain goes away. Then the dopamine exceeds the acetylcholine. This is not a simple issue of being weak-willed or choice. Choice is not just driven by what you would consider to be your personality and who you are. We are born liking sugar twice as much as our own mothers. Crying goes down 50% with sugar sucker and only 30% with maternal breastfeeding. We like it twice as much as our own mothers. We're only 5 minutes old. So that's during the heel lance for blood draw, right after birth. And that's not a children with special conditions. That's the average person. And mouse studies show that when you give a mouse sugar for 12 hours and then take it away for 12, give it back for 12, take it away for 12, and you do that for a few weeks, they'll eat 50% more sugar because taking it away increases the drive for it. And the mice that constantly have low-dose sugar actually eat a quarter less after a few weeks. They get tired of it, which is why if you're not full-blown addicted to sugar, where just eating a little bit causes a re-triggering event where you can't stop, if you're just in the strong craving mode and haven't crossed over into addiction, you can use a technique called preemptive controlled binging, where you know every week you're going to binge, so every 2 weeks you do a small binge intentionally. You do it intentionally to satisfy that dopamine drive before it takes you over, because willpower fatigues like a muscle. That's the title of a research paper published in the journal Medical Hypothesis.
We're going to take a break. You're listening to the KZSU Monday Lunch Hour Special. We'll be back. Welcome back to the KZSU Monday Lunch Hour Special. We're talking with Dr. Clyde Wilson, and I was just about to ask him about what to eat. There's so much information out there, and it's such a complicated eating environment that we live in. Dr. Wilson, how do we make decisions every day? How do we become more conscious of this stuff?
There's two very different ways to approach eating. One is when you're eating natural, unprocessed foods. We know from different societies throughout the world that the body is highly adaptable to almost anything that you put into it when it's unprocessed. For example, in the Chinese countryside, so these are in relatively undeveloped regions, fat intake is about 10% of total calories. The traditional Greek Mediterranean diet, 45% of the calories are fats. The Inuit and the Cree near the Arctic Circle, 80% of their calories are fats. And yet there's almost no cancer, heart disease, no record of diabetes in these cultures. That tells us that the body can be healthy with almost anything that you put into it when it's not processed. This is the reason why a lot of experts out there say correctly that you really can't figure out how we should eat, because almost anything that you put into the body, it does just fine. However, as soon as you process foods, they digest faster and the calories will enter your bloodstream faster than your lean tissues can absorb them, forcing your fat tissues to absorb them instead. And there is a subsequent rise in multiple disease risks concurrent with the increase in body fat. And this has led to us chasing after non-existent demons in nutrition, like don't eat fats, which we did for over a quarter century, and now don't eat carbs, which we're a couple decades into as well, and has particularly picked up steam in the last 10 years. When you don't understand the enemy, then you will pick and choose artificial enemies and kind of like with musical chairs, cycle between them as if you understand what you're doing, but it's the blind man looking at the different parts of the elephant instead of seeing the whole elephant. So the bottom line is this. When you take oats or wheat or corn and you grind it down and make cornflakes or turn it into bagels or Cheerios made out of oats, for example, yes, all this stuff is whole grain. but it's not in the coarse grain form that the earth provided it. And I'm not saying we shouldn't cook our food to make it softer, and which would chip our teeth so we can't even keep eating. I mean, I'm fine with cooking food. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you start grinding stuff down and it digests 2 to 3 times faster, that's where your lean tissues can't keep up and the spillover calories goes into your fat cells. This is a kinetics problem. Kinetics is basically, in any area of science, kinetics looks at how fast is stuff happening. When calories enter your bloodstream faster than your lean tissues can absorb them, they have to go to body fat. That's body fat's job. You would think you can exercise and burn that fat, but that is not completely true, because the food that we're eating combines with the oxygen that we're breathing to generate a molecule called adenosine triphosphate, ATP, and that is our fuel molecule that puts together the amino acids we're eating into protein, that drives thoughts in our brain, it drives digestion, muscle contraction, and muscle is half of our metabolic rate. So if the carbohydrates we're eating go to fat, we generate ATP 3 times slower, and now you have a weaker, mentally slower version of you. You literally take your personality away from yourself. There are even studies looking at inspiration levels and creativity. So if you reduce your reaction time and your ability to think and your physical energy because carbohydrates have entered too quickly and spilled over into fat instead of going into lean tissues, you'd need to brisk walk for 10 hours at a shot and think for 5 hours instead of one to get any kind of exercise or mental task completed. You want the highest energy version of you to raise your metabolism, reduce disease risk, increase your mental focus and reaction time, and your physical energy so that you're here longer and can get more done each day. And it goes beyond that. There is a profound aspect of quality of life that comes with the increased mood and function. For example, let's say you work 12 hours, get home, you're so tired, you don't even want to hear what your kids have to say. They're the reason you went to work with to begin with. If you don't want to listen to your spouse and your kids or don't have any time for your friends, why are you even going to work? And yet, we get so stressed out at work, we'll spike our blood sugar with soda and cake, etc. So how do fats and proteins figure into the picture? Well, if you overeat those things, you're actually less hungry later on. If you overeat carbohydrates, you're more hungry later. It's the only food group where you want to eat more in response to eating too much. So for every excess calorie of protein or fats, you get a calorie fatter. We all get that. Calories in, calories out. But for every excess calorie of carbohydrates, you might get 3 or 4 calories fatter because of the increased cravings and hunger, which you cannot avoid.
It's a multiplier inevitable. Effect.
There's a multiplier effect, absolutely. And fructose, which is the sugar processed by the liver, is particularly toxic, which is why Robert Lustig wrote an editorial in Nature or Science a couple weeks ago that we should tax it because it's habituating, not quite addicting, doesn't quite reach that level, but it is habituating, and it's a national security threat. 1/4 of people trying to apply to the military, they're overweight. Now it's even put into hamburger buns. And you can't blame McDonald's. If they don't put it in there, you'll go to Jack in the Box instead. We're looking for this as a survival instinct. We have this beautifully designed lab on a chip, lab on a tongue, in our mouths that tell us when something is coming in that's helping us to survive. And that generates an opioid release, just like cocaine entering the bloodstream. Opioids released by the brain, which makes us like that. Oftentimes, I've heard people say, well, I like this, and that's my personality. No, that's not your personality. We're all born liking sugar. The nuances of the flavors that are stacked onto the sugar, whether you like this type of ice cream or that, that is personality. That is choice. But the underlying sugar drive and the savory drive and the fat drive, if you combine them, like into pizza, fat and carb, or a donut, fat and carb, boy, now the only thing remaining is satiety. So you don't want to just stop at one. You want to eat 12 donuts. You're combining the sugar and the fat and the satiety drive all at the same time. So how do you fix this problem? The reality is most people can't join the slow food movement. Michael Pollan, who's one of the leaders in that, Marion Nestle, eat unprocessed foods, stuff that has just 1 or 2 ingredients, things that your grandmother would recognize. Don't put anything else into your body. If you do that, it almost doesn't matter how you eat. You can eat like the rural Chinese, the traditional Greek Mediterranean, or the Inuit and the Cree. It doesn't make any difference. Put whatever you want in your body, you're completely healthy. That is not most of our scenarios. And that's the reason that I have that I have all these classes to teach and these clients and students to work with, because they're not eating as part of the slow food movement. They don't have time. Sometimes they don't have much money. They eat whatever comes to the meetings or the candy bowl at the front of the counter. There's no broccoli cauliflower bowl at the front counter at work. And grand rounds at the doctor's, if it's lunchtime, they're eating there's pizzas delivered. If it's morning, it's bagels and cupcakes. And this is medical doctors. Walter Willett said he went to a conference one time on healthy eating. He showed up 10 minutes late to the surreal scene of nutrition researchers talking about how to improve nutrition throughout the country eating junk food. Surreal. So the reality is that our willpower cannot overcome our survival instinct until there's a death scare, or if you're an athlete where you care so much about your performance that you don't have to wait for your doctor to tell you that you're halfway to dead at the age of 20 or 60. So how can we manage pizza, ice cream, etc., because that's the reality of our lives. We aren't all going to start going to the farmer's market and spending an hour every day preparing vegetables and cooking. I don't even do that. So here's the two-step process to approach the problem. First, eat the foods that you like, and that's going to result in half your foods being relatively unhealthy. But now comes the second piece. Slow down the rate that the calories come into your bloodstream so that they don't keep overflowing to fats, because you will never burn them in time. They'll keep accumulating. And even though body fat doesn't cause disease directly, the disease risk is going up concurrently. It's happening at the same time in parallel. So disease risk is going up with the increase in body fat. I'm working with a five-time All-American who was in the Olympics, and he's a medical doctor. He's on high blood pressure meds from all the Gatorade and the power bars because of all the sucrose intake. So six-pack his whole life, amazing athlete, one of the fastest people in the world. And yet 10 years after his peak competition days, he's still on medication because of the plaque buildup in his arteries, the fat production from his liver from all the sugar intake. Sugar is a reality of our lives, whether you're an athlete or you don't have time or you're not getting along with your spouse or you don't like your job. There's not enough dopamine quenching, opioid release from those things, and you don't have time for therapy or don't even trust it. And so you can satisfy this with a Band-Aid, which is with sugar and to a lesser extent about one-third as strong fats and also about as strong as fats, satiety. So sugar and fats and satiety put together, most people, the salt and the savory is not as large a drive. You need to accept who you are. We're born this way. So how can you add something that will mitigate the negatives that come from these foods? Deciding that you don't like pizza and sugar is a complete waste of time. There's this saying that I'm not going to be able to quote it exactly, but it's basically accept the things that you can't change, recognize the things that you can, have the strength to know the difference. I can't remember the quote exactly, and I'm sure that probably 99% of the listeners have heard this quote before. So don't try to not like sugar. You are wasting your time. You will just hate yourself and eat even more sugar than ever before. When I was a graduate student here at Stanford, I did this mouse study on myself with the binging. I wouldn't eat ice cream for a whole month, and I hated myself for not eating. And then I'd go to the Haagen-Dazs store, because I think I'm a ice cream aficionado, and this is the sophisticated. But I saved money with a quart compared to the scoops, because a scoop is $2 and a whole quart is $8. Since I'm a graduate student, I'm like, well, let's save the money. So now it's melting, and I'm eating the melt along the outside, and then you've got this little mountain in the middle, and it's starting to melt. And I'm like, well, if I refreeze it, it won't have the right consistency. And since I'm an ice cream aficionado, I might as well just finish it. And the amount of gastrointestinal upset for 3 days straight was unbelievable. So for a month, I hate myself for not eating it, and then for 3 days, I hate myself for eating it. I went through back and forth in two different states of self-hatred. And I see people do this all the time. They think that they can choose to not want something, that they're a bad person for not being able to follow through on deciding that they don't want sugar anymore. You're born this way. This is your survival instinct. Accept who you are. But you can add vegetables to slow down the digestion rate. How big of an impact can this make? It's profound. So let me give you some numbers. I've done some nutrition interventions with the veterans at the Veterans Administration here in Palo Alto. So not official research, just coming in, making some suggestions to them. Not real research, but they test their blood sugar. I'm not asking them to test their blood sugar. They're already doing that. And I don't have to ask them to eat white bread. They are eating white bread. So here's my suggestion. Why don't you try some whole grain bread? So their blood sugar rise will go from 100 mg per deciliter to 200. So it'll about double. And they'll be using like 8 units of insulin. They switch to whole grain bread, slows down digestion 10%, blood sugar rise maybe only 190. so they have to use almost just as much insulin. They had 2 cups of vegetables, it only goes to 120. Digestion rate goes down 80%. That's like eating coarse, raw steel-cut oats without even cooking it, just because you added some vegetables to junk food. It's profound. I don't eat pizza without salad anymore. I take pre-washed kale to In-N-Out Burger. And when you've got kale and a burger in your mouth at the same time, the kale tastes a lot like, guess what? A burger. And lettuce in my mouth at the same time as pizza tastes a lot like, guess what? Pizza. Because if you're eating vegetables by itself, you have to add 500 calories of fat in the form of dressing to even choke it down. People will say to me, how can you eat 2, 3, even 4 times the volume of vegetables as everything else to slow it down its digestion enough to actually be healthy from eating pizza? I don't worry about dressing. I don't even take the time to make salads. I do not make salads, and I do not cook. I eat pizza, burgers, and whatever I want, and I have 3 or 4 times the volume of vegetables, more vegetables than I've ever seen anybody eat. I'm sure there's people out there that eat more, but I've never seen it. I mean, people think it's almost like stand-up comedy.
It's incredible. I think you're clearly a mountain of a man and a mountain of information, and we're very impressed with it. Give me 1 minute. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Dr. Clyde Wilson. Welcome back to the KZSU Lunch Hour Special. We're speaking with Dr. Clyde Wilson. Something you mentioned in the last segment that kind of caught my ear is this distinction between habituation and addiction. How do you draw that line? Where is that line?
In terms of studies with organisms other than human beings, it's pretty easy to look at the biochemical processes, the strength of the withdrawal effect. And with addicts, whether it's drugs or even with caffeine, you can notice, or nicotine, you can see a genuine withdrawal effect. With sugars, which is the strongest of the food categories that generates a habituation, it doesn't technically meet the standards of a withdrawal, which is why the psychological research community has come up with a new term, which is strong cravings, because you do have re-triggering events where not eating sugar for a while and then falling into the trap of eating some will trigger consuming it in large quantities with a seeming inability to stop. But there have not been enough studies with people that have habituated their sugar intake enough to achieve a technically high enough level of strong cravings to achieve what is technically called addiction. I am pretty sure that there are individuals that do, but not enough of them within the groups that are in research studies to meet that qualification. But if you ask people, like particularly like an Overeaters Anonymous, they'll say straight up, first thing, I am an addict.
And it seems to me that, these definitions, these distinctions between addiction and intense habituation are on some level arbitrary, because even if we can't necessarily measure the addiction response, the behavior is akin to the same thing.
Absolutely. So there's a spectrum there. And I would add that it's not just how much you like something, most likely, that drives you to do something, but relative to how much you like to do other things. So, for example, your marriage is going well, your work is going well, your need for sugar becomes less. Things aren't going so well, there's not enough opioids released from your work and your friendships, etc., then the drive will be more. Then there is a whole separate piece, which is the hormonal milieu that is acting on the hypothalamus to drive cravings and hunger sensation. So if you're low on protein, you won't have as much cholecystokinin. Low on fats, not as much leptin. Low on sugar, then you'll have very low insulin levels, unless you go through binging processes, in which case insulin ends up high, but your hypothalamus will become insulin resistant and therefore not even recognize it, which will raise your cravings and hunger. So different food groups result in different hormonal stimuli to reduce hunger sensation. Hunger and cravings are a perception, just like the color red. The color red does not exist outside of the mind. The universe is grayscale, and there is no such thing as tangible hunger. And one of the additional reasons that we know this to be true, besides the fact that it is perception driven by hormones, is that the body is in the deepest in the start state when we wake up in the morning, and yet the limbic system determines whether we feel any pain or hunger or anything at all. If you got to get your kids to school and you got to rush to work, whatever matters to you most, those are the things that will be allowed through your thalamus to your sensory cortex and then to your neocortex so that you can become prefrontal cortex to be consciously aware of this. You won't even be aware of hunger when you care about other things a lot. And after your workout, you won't feel hungry because of the sympathetic nervous system. Your fight or flight response will reduce your hunger. You know, it's interesting. In my undergraduate introduction to nutrition course, I've had as much as 120 kids in there, with 60 of them raising their hands that they don't feel hungry in the morning when I ask. And once I tell them that their body eats itself alive until they finally get to some food, all of a sudden, over 50% of those that had not been feeling any hungry are hungry when they wake up. That sensation is allowed through because now they care enough and they recognize the negatives.
It's the power of suggestion, but it's more profound than that.
It's more profound because now they have an acetylcholine recognition that there's something bad happening when they don't eat. And that is in the emotion center in their brain. That same little almond-shaped nucleus accumbens that I was talking about earlier, where acetylcholine went up in response to my doctor, I've raised that in them. So that the limbic system now prioritizes eating more and allows the hunger perception to even get through. It isn't that they were high enough in fuel before and now they're low in fuel when they wake up. The body was always low in fuel, but the perception has changed. And there's some amazing work by researcher last name Baumeister just in the last couple of years that has shown that a slightly low blood sugar from not eating breakfast or not enough breakfast, and maybe you spike your blood sugar at lunch with a burrito with rice, and the insulin clears it out, so you end up with a low blood sugar from that. So low blood sugar from either no carbs or from too much carbs. Either way, low blood sugar. And your hypothalamus, this same part of the brain that drives cravings and hunger perception, will see just a slight drop in blood sugar through the day, perceive that as starvation, and give you 50% greater hunger than the calories you need at night. So you end up overeating, unavoidably so, because hunger is almost a form of nociception or pain. It's not something that you can just ignore. So you have to manage your hunger by getting the whole milieu of hormones from each food group in each meal. In terms of putting a meal together, with the carbs and the protein together, the carbs will be your fuel to put the amino acids from the protein back together to keep your cells healthy. So carbs and protein need to be in your meal. And if you're going to pass 100 calories of carbs, which is like a slice of bread or a third to a half cup of rice, pasta, cereal, etc., or corn, adding a vegetable, if you've got more than 100 calories of the carb, the volumes that I just described, that'll slow down the carbs so that they get into the cell. That way you're not urinating out your protein, so the carbs actually get into the cell so that they can be used as a fuel source to put the protein back together. You can think of protein as the bricks to build the house and the carbs as the workers to put it together. You put bricks on your front lawn, you're not going to have a house the next morning. You put a bunch of workers on your front lawn, they don't have any bricks to put the house together. You got to have the bricks and the workers there at the same time. But fats do not need to be in that meal. They can be in your snack, or in wherever in your meals that you want them, as long as you get the proper balance of fats throughout your day. The omega-3s, 6s, monounsaturated fats, and it turns out that animal fats actually raise health as long as you don't pass 7% of your total calories of them. So the fats can be anywhere, but the meals need to have the carbs and the protein, and if the carbs go past 100, 200 calories, depends on your metabolism, which is dependent on a lot of things, age, height, weight, activity levels, gender, depending on how much carbs, then the vegetables need to be there. And if they're not, then you need to reduce the meal size and increase how many times you eat. So 6 small meals a day, or 3 larger meals with vegetables added, or if you just want to do 3 meals and not add the vegetables, then you can eat the slowest digesting carbs. You can switch the bread and the rice and cereal out with legumes. I call it legume boot camp. It's like 4 or 5 pounds of weight loss a week. It's unbelievable. Because legumes, and this is why they produce so much gas, digest so slow that a quarter of the calories get to the colon where the bacteria digest it for you, and they produce gas as a byproduct. So gas is a direct measure of high levels of physical health. Social health, not so much, but physical health, definitely. So if you space out your meals smaller, or have the big meals with vegetables added to slow them down, or switch out the carbs with the slowest digesting version, which is the legumes, it doesn't make any difference to your cells. Look, I'm a chemist. To me, what your cells see determines their health, determines the health of the organism overall. It doesn't matter if you're shoving pizza or lentils in your mouth. What matters is your chemistry in your bloodstream. If you have pizza with salad, with a lot of salad, it's going to digest as slow as eggs with low-fat refried beans. And when I have 3-4 pieces of pizza at Round Table Pizza, that's where my nephews like to go, I have one big salad with each piece of pizza. Wow. And 6 hours later, I still feel the food in my stomach. That's like having one piece of pizza every 2 hours. That's the experience of the cells in my body. I'm not spiking my blood sugar. It's not overflowing to fat, resulting in a low blood sugar, which then makes me hungrier later. Instead, I'm having the effect of 3 small pizza meals over 6 to 8 hours, but I did it as one meal all at once in a one-hour space of time with my family.
In some ways, it sounds very simple, and in other ways, it does sound like it took some time to develop this discipline, at least in terms of developing the knowledge of what happened. I mean, can you walk us through the process of how you began to regiment your own diet?
Well, back in the Navy, on the ship, I just use my common sense, and studies show that control groups in weight loss studies, when they're told to not change anything, that just being consciously aware of what they're eating, because they're going to get asked each week by a registered dietitian what they've eaten, just being consciously engaged, they lose at least half as much weight as the intervention group. It's profound. They're not taught how to eat, they're told not to change anything, and yet just being consciously engaged somehow leads to them eating healthier, even when they think that they're not changing what they're doing.
So step one is being conscious.
Absolutely. Conscious nutrition consciousness, as opposed to mindless eating. Brian Wansink's term. He wrote a book by that name. He's got over 100 papers out there. He's a nutrition psychologist, and fascinating work. So consciousness in eating, just paying attention, simply asking yourself the question, what went in water today? What went in water are you doing? Just asking yourself that question with zero knowledge, you're going to get 50% of your target. Beyond that, you can start eating unprocessed foods. And whenever you eat processed foods, add a vegetable, which is the only unprocessed foods that will slow down digestion enough to deal with the pizza and the burgers. Adding apples and carrots, which are as high in calories, and tomatoes, which are as high in calories as apples. So high-calorie vegetables and fruit, you need 300 calories of them to slow down 300 calories of carbs. You just doubled your calories, and it ends up backfiring as a result. So you need the lower-calorie vegetables, which is most vegetables. And don't peel anything unless it's going to chip your teeth when you eat it. You know, peeling a cucumber, to me, it's like I'm horrified. I have like an anxiety attack whenever I see somebody peeling a cucumber. At Thanksgiving one time, my mom did that, and I had this anxiety attack. And when everybody got their salad, she put this big pile of cucumber peelings from everybody right next to my salad, and we were all laughing about it. And I ate all of it, too. So it's the crunch factor. You know how much a vegetable slows down digestion by how much you chew it. You know, you got to have simple thumb rules. In order for this to work, you ask the question, how did I develop this over the years? In order to get this to work, knowledge isn't enough. I used to think that if I understand nutrition, I'll do the right thing. But guess what? I have so much sugar habituation from before I was even 2 years old, from my grandma, bless her heart. That's one of the ways she shared love, and I love her for it, and it doesn't bother me. Problems are meant to help us learn and overcome and to make us stronger. I believe that, and that form of love for my grandma has engaged me in a problem that has enabled me to help other people. She has helped others through me with that version of love that she gave me. That's how I choose to look at that, and I think if she were still with us, that she would be in complete agreement with me. So what I developed over the years wasn't so much an improvement in my understanding. As I was teaching food pharmacology at these two different places, so twice a year, each year over the last 9 years, sure, I understood the chemistry more and more, but the superficial part, eat salad, eat fibrous stuff, drink water, that never changed. And when you're making a food, we had this saying in the Navy, you measure it with a micrometer, mark it with chalk, and cut it with an axe. The micrometer is the thought process. But to get through life, you just slop food in a tray and shove it in your body. Who has time to measure out their foods? Well, I mean, there's a lot of people on the weight loss registry that do measure out their foods. But I think for most people, that's not going to work. If it works for a person that matches their personality, then I think that's fantastic. But for most people, just saying, well, I'm going to put a thumb or two of fats on my plate and a palm volume of carbs and a palm volume of protein and a fist volume of vegetables. And if I want to lose weight, maybe 2 fists of vegetables. And if you need more calories, you know, like I'm working with Will Switek in the NFL. He's 340 pounds. Ryan Hall's another one of my athletes. He's 130 pounds. So opposite ends of the spectrum, a strength athlete, an endurance athlete. And their ratios stay roughly the same, but Will Svitek will have 8 fists of vegetables with 5 to 6 palms of carbs, whereas Ryan Hall will have a little bit less. Of course, he trains hard, so he's eating a lot of palms of carbs and protein as well. But you keep those ratios roughly in balance, and if you eat unprocessed foods, the ratios stop mattering. The ratios are most important when you're eating processed carbohydrates, because if you overeat the carbs, you end up in the trouble that I was talking about earlier. And we need consistent protein to optimize performance for trainings that are at a higher level than our body is designed for. Mm-hmm. And running a marathon in 2 hours and 7 minutes, or being on the front line on an NFL football team, that is not what the body is designed for. So the nutrition really has to push you hard. And the body is not designed for 16-hour workdays as a business person or as a medical doctor either. And having energy left over for your kids when you get home, so you get through the marathon ticker at the end of the finish line and you don't collapse and need to go to the emergency room, but can actually play with your kids and show them love, as opposed to having a suppressed mood because of a low blood sugar and low amino acid levels.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Clyde Wilson about the mind, the body, nutrition, and how to think about life. It's some pretty profound stuff here. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break. If you're just joining us, we're into our final segment with Dr. Clyde Wilson, and when we last left off, we were talking about the mind and the body. And Dr. Wilson teaches courses in kinesiology. If you're not familiar with that word, it means human movement. Can you tell us a little bit more about your course?
The course is 2.5 months. The first 4 to 5 weeks is basic anatomy, structure of the body, and the second half of the course is really where my training lies. I was studying nerve signaling as a graduate student, muscle contraction and fatigue in the Cardiovascular Research Center up at UCSF as a postdoc. And that is the theory of movement. I love to think about molecules and cells. Of course, the whole organism is moving, so these cells are working together in profound ways. But I love to zero in down on the muscle fiber and the neuron and how it's signaling. What are the and coordinating those muscle fibers? What is the damage process? So like when your muscles are activated and they're lengthening, they have more damage. Why is that? What is the recovery process? How your immune system comes in and clears out the damage first. Most people think, for example, that they should drink a protein shake after their workout, and they completely ignore the carbs. And yet, until your immune system, white blood cells, clear out the damage, you can't even grow. And when they come in and digest that damaged material, they peak in their density and population in those regions and the removal of the damaged material 1-2 days later. And those digestive enzymes that they're releasing induces pain. We call it delayed onset muscle soreness. That's when you would drink the protein shake. You can't even build muscle very quickly when the rubble is still there. If your house comes down in an earthquake, are you going to build on top of the rubble, or are you going to clear it out first? Your immune system clears out the rubble. Then your satellite cells, which are dormant nuclei, slither to the region of damage, and they start building up because the regular active nuclei aren't populous enough to generate enough protein to recover. So when you understand what's happening with the molecules in the cells, you can start to think about the practical applications of how to time your protein, how to periodize your training. Like, for example, you stop training, your nervous system detrains twice as fast as your muscles. So if you train really hard, you're going to have all this muscle damage that might take a week to recover from, depending on how hard the workout is. But by the time you fully recover, your nerves and nerve signaling and how your muscles coordinate has already detrained the last few days. So it's 2 steps forward, 1 step back. Well, if you're trying to optimize performance, or even just optimize your health, you want to optimize your adaptation to training. You don't want 2 steps forward, 1 step back. You want 2 steps forward, 2 steps forward, 2 steps forward. So what do? Halfway between your hard workouts, you do technique training or lower weight with faster movement. So it's the same power output, the same amount of force through distance. So let's say benching half the weight with twice the number of reps in a 10-second time period, so that your nervous system sees the same training adaptation is the heavier weight moved slowly, but you don't have as much muscle damage. So it enables your muscles to continue recovering and avoid the nervous system detraining at the same time. So you go back and forth between heavier with lower reps and then lighter with faster reps to take advantage of these two different rates of recovery and kinetics, so that it's always 2 steps forward with no steps backwards.
You know, you mentioned recovery, and I'm an NBA fan, and I heard an interview not too long ago with Charles Barkley where somebody asked him, what was the big difference as you aged throughout your career? And he said, recovery time. And it seems like we've made a lot of progress. And sticking on the NBA for a second, you know, I think of Steve Nash, who is 38, 39, and still able to perform in the NBA. Has there been a lot of progress in recent years on this sort of science?
How long it takes to recovery is multiple factors. So there's the clearance rate from the immune system, and then there is the protein production rate of the nuclei and the dormant nuclei that are activated, the satellite cells, and then there's the delivery of nutrients and oxygen to fuel that process. As you age, the hormonal drives for growth, testosterone, growth hormone, and other transcription factors declines. The cardiorespiratory and nutrient delivery capacity declines, and your protein production rate declines. So the nutrient, damage removal, and protein production, all of them slowly drop with age. Fortunately, if you do proper stress reduction, sleep quality, nutrition, and periodization of your training, you can take your body back the equivalent of 10 to 20 years worth relative to not doing those things. Wow. The reality is, and what I found with younger athletes that I work with a lot of people in their late teens, 20s, their genetics are good enough that they don't even realize that they haven't optimized their performance. And it wouldn't be until they're 40 or 50 years old where things are declining where they would normally want to come to me and then all of a sudden realize that they're doing so much better. If they would have taken advantage of that earlier, maybe they would have gotten to the Olympics or a D1 team, NCAAs, et cetera. We oftentimes don't take into consideration that even when you're young, when your performance is high, that it could even be higher. Of course, the relative difference in performance is going to be smaller when your genetics and your age, when your body's better off. So as you age, let's say your performance has dropped by 20%, you can get most of that 20% drop back relative to 10 to 20 years earlier. So it is a relative change. Mm. It might feel like you're making yourself younger, but you could have actually induced similar changes, not as large a magnitude, when you were younger.
We only have a few minutes left before we have to wrap up, and something I'd really wanted to ask you about is alcohol and alcohol consumption, especially since our audience is largely young college students who sometimes just turned 21. And I'm not quite sure how to tee up that question, but I'm sure you have some thoughts on it.
Alcohol has negative and positive effects. I like to joke with my students that it's a horrific biochemical poison until you're 21, and suddenly the biochemistry of the body changes so that there's some positives that trickle in. So don't dare drink it before that biochemical shift. So what are the negatives? There's reduced albumin and protein production, reduced neutrophil count, so your immune system drops, testosterone by as much as 25%, growth hormone by as much as 100% with just six drinks, and 75% with just three drinks. So alcohol reduces growth hormone releasing protein, which reduces the depth of your sleep and also growth hormone release. So I like to say whether you're drinking because you won or lost the game, you are not recovering that night. So it's important from a recovery perspective, both from growth hormone and testosterone, as well as hydration, which increases water, single-handedly raises testosterone and growth hormone, and alcohol is a weak diuretic. So even if you drink a lot of water with alcohol, you're still going to have a net fluid loss once you pass just a couple drinks. But small, moderate intake on a daily basis or every other day reduces dementia, raises HDL, increases endothelial cell health, so that's your circulatory system. So it's a 24 to 48 hour effect and comes from small dose over regular intervals every day or so. You cannot compensate for not drinking for 7 days by binge drinking on Sunday. Hmm. It turns out that it completely backfires. As soon as you go past about 1.5, depending on your body weight, my NFL or 2 drinks maybe, it's not that much. Just 1.5 to 2 drinks. It immediately crosses over into the negative, including over time brain shrinkage. I mean, it's profound. It's the way that alcohol is processed, mainly by the liver, forces the liver to produce fats. So it triggers fat production, even though alcohol is not directly fat. That's where it's metabolized. Some is metabolized in the kidneys and some in the brain. And that's why alcohol contributes to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and high blood lipid counts, even if you're cadaverously thin. You could be under-eating, be extremely thin. You're going to have organ fat accumulation, which is the worst place to have fats in your body. The worst is organs. The second is the belly, and that's the second place where it accumulates. And then the least unhealthy place, actually it's fine to have plenty of it, is subcutaneous fat. That's what babies have a lot of. And there's whole cultures in the world like Samoans, parts in the Philippines where there's a lot of subcutaneous fat that is not correlated to disease risk. So what I like to tell people about alcohol is that if you pace it, and have low doses regularly. And the same is true with phytonutrients or even green tea. You saturate the benefits. Now, green tea in large amounts doesn't hurt you like alcohol does, but you saturate in the benefits. You have to wait 6 hours before a cup is going to help you again. So it's almost always a kinetics problem. Like red meat actually will increase estrogen and testosterone. I've worked with several female athletes who were able to get menstruation back from eating cheese and bacon. One of them had been on hormone replacement therapy for 3 years, and they were getting ready to adopt a child. I mean, adoption's great, but she wanted one of her own children, and now she has that. And I've got a high-level soccer player, exact same scenario. So it turns out that animal fats can be good for you, and if you drink 3 gallons of water all at once, you'll be dead almost as fast as consuming cyanide. So what's more toxic? Cheese and pepperoni and ribs, or water? Water is infinitely more toxic. Animal fats will kill you in 50 years, carbs in 30 years, water in just a few minutes, because that dilutes the sodium so much that you can't send a signal. So it's the kinetics. How fast is the water coming in? What's the rate that the carbs are coming in? How fast are the ribs coming in over the years? How fast is the alcohol coming in on a daily basis? So it's not that... eating candy in the morning if you're not going to eat breakfast, and I have a client where I told him to do that, and now all of a sudden they're eating breakfast every day. Just 50 to 100 calories of candy, that doesn't spike their blood sugar when they're in the starved state, and they're finally eating breakfast for the first time in their life. It's actually good for them because the body will stop eating itself alive. We need to stop hating on foods. We need to stop with our belief systems. And instead, think about the rates that things are coming in. And understand that when we say this is good in moderation, that you can put numbers on that. 1 to 1.5 drinks of alcohol per day. A few liters of water per day, more if you're exercising. The amount of grams of protein per kilogram body weight matters less than the consistency of the protein coming in. There's a study with New York City police officers that shows that when they space their protein out, they get twice the muscle growth, twice the fat loss, and 40% more power gains in the gym with the same amount of protein just by spacing it out. This is a kinetics problem. If you ask me the question, I'll go ahead and ask myself, Clyde, what is at the heart and soul of eating healthier within a toxic nutrition environment? Of not eating, you're not eating a lot of unprocessed foods. How do you survive that? You think about the kinetics. You ask yourself two questions. It's a two-step process. First, what do I want to eat? If you're not eating what you want to eat, you don't love yourself enough. You need to start eating what you want to eat. But then comes the second question and the second part of self-love, which is, how are you going to slow down its digestion? If you don't like vegetables, space out the calories, eat more beans than pasta. If you're willing to eat vegetables, then you can go almost crazy with the carbs, as long as you have a greater volume of vegetables than carbs. And if you're not losing weight with twice the volume of vegetables to carbs, then go to 3 times the volume of vegetables to carbs. Reducing body fat is like gear shifts in a car. You go from second gear to third gear to fourth gear to get greater and greater weight loss by having a higher ratio. And if you cook the vegetables, now it's soft. It's not slowing down the digestion rate. So you'll fight cancer more. You get greater phytonutrient availability by cooking your vegetables. But it's the raw stuff that slows down digestion. And it doesn't matter if it's celery or iceberg lettuce. There's no nutrients in that stuff. You're not going to fight cancer with that. But you're going to lose just as much weight and slow down the carbs just as much with celery as you will with broccoli. And as soon as you cook stuff or blend it, you remove that element. So it's not about how much fiber's in there. Absolutely not. It's how coarse is it. If you have to chew it, then it's going to mix with the carbs in your stomach, slow down the rate that it empties, and as long as you've got consistent protein with it, it will fuel the protein production process, your cells will be healthy, and therefore you will be healthy.
Well, Dr. Wilson, this has been this has been a blast.
I think so.
I mean that in more ways than one. It's been awesome. I think I know what I want to be getting from either the farmer's market or the Whole Foods or Safeway or wherever. I feel like I'm armed and ready to start thinking about my digestion on a lot of different levels.
Go to the farmer's market and then the pizzeria.
All right. I'm all over it. Well, thanks again for coming in. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.